Blog Talk Radio.
Live from New York, you're listening to New York Baseball Digest with Mike Silva.
It's another edition of the 24/7 365 Digest of New York Baseball. That's nybaseballdigest.com. Hope everybody's doing well here on this Sunday, December the 11th. Want to welcome everybody in, and I want to get right to it. We got a lot to talk about over the next hour. And let's get to our first guest. As I had been mentioning over at the website, I have with us a former big league pitcher for the Braves, author of a new book, Scars and Strikes. He's with us now, John Rocker. John, thanks for joining us here on this late Sunday night. How are you?
I'm good, Mike. I appreciate you having me on tonight.
No problem. The website, by the way, everybody, is johnrocker.net. And I guess I'll start off, John. It's been more than a decade since the Jeff Perlman essay article. Unfortunately for you, that's always what everybody wants to talk about. Is writing this book a response to that, or is it a lot bigger than that? I mean, I guess that's the first question everyone asks when they think about this project.
Yeah, it is a lot bigger than that. Obviously, I didn't write an entire book that was based on one single article, and obviously a perception that was created from that one single article. It is a lot bigger than that. You know, there is a lot of baseball in there, a lot of baseball memoir, you know, kind of stuff in there. A lot of great stories about my time in the big leagues, discussing individuals, you know, such as Jim Thome and Walt Weiss and Ellis Burks, and you know, a lot of just the tremendous guys I played with, you know, while I was in the game. But there definitely is a portion of the book that does deal with that SI article and does deal with the, you know, in what I know to be fact, the gross perception that article did create about me. And for years and years and years, I did try to dispel that perception, through TV interviews, through radio interviews like the one I'm doing now, through various print formats and things like that, and just never really thought I got the fair shake and the fair, the fair adjustment of that perception. The old cliche is, you know, don't ever pick a fight with a guy who buys ink by the truckload. And I've actually got a quote in the book that says, I finally decided to buy my own truck. So, there is a large portion, probably 40% of the book that does deal with that and does deal with, my perception, as I and so many people that know me very well as we see it, not from a third-party perspective, that really has no more interest in the perception around me than to continue to perpetuate the sensationalism and things like that, to sell magazines, generate, you know, ratings for a TV or radio program, sell newspapers, things like that. It actually is the legitimate actual perception of me as myself and so many others that have known me for, 20, 30 years as those people see it. It's a much more accurate perception than what I've received from third parties over the years.
I have with me John Rocker, former big league pitcher, has a website, johnrocker.net, and a book out, Scars and Strikes. And John, writing this book, you're a young guy. You're 37 years old. I know you had some shoulder injuries toward the end of your career. Did you get the juices? Do you feel like playing again? I mean, did any of that old memories conjure up and say, hey, I wish I could be out there and still be throwing strikes and closing out ball games?
Part of me still does. I'll tell you a funny story. I actually went down to a Major League Baseball alumni game in Orlando back in June. Any thoughts for a comeback were quickly dispelled during and shortly thereafter that game. It was not a pleasant physical experience to actually get on the mound and actually try to pitch to hitters again. So. The whole comeback thing was ruled out definitively after that game.
And I think that's something that many of the listeners may not realize. A lot of people figure that it was the article and the attention that drove you away from the game. You just physically couldn't do it anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was playing for Texas, and obviously I'm something that people probably perceive about me and perceive correctly. I am a hard-headed guy. Unfortunately, I'm a hard-headed guy when it comes to my playing days, too. I played for 13 years professionally. I was on the disabled list one time, and I never came off. And probably, only being on the DL one time, and just all the injuries you fight through, and, heck no, my teammates depend on me my coaching staff depends on me. The fans that follow the Atlanta Braves and the Cleveland Indians, the Texas Rangers, they depend on me. I'm being paid to play this game. But unless, you know, something's bleeding or something's broken, I'm out there playing every night. And finally, you just drive your body to a certain extent where it just can't recover anymore. And I ended up, when I was in Texas, having a pretty severe injury. I tried to play through it, tried to pitch through it. I knew surgery was going to be, if I went that route, was going to be probably a 1 to 2 year hiatus, which I really didn't want to do. I chose to go the rehab route as opposed to the surgery route. I would take a month off here, a month off there, kept trying to play. You know, fine, when I bit the bullet and had surgery, the diagnosis I got from Jim Andrews in Birmingham was not a very pleasant one. I had you have 5 rotator cuff muscles. I had 2 that were 85% torn. My labrum muscle was torn away from the bone. I had a spur on my acromion. I had to get my shoulder cap full shrunk. I had about a chunk of scar tissue taken off. My bicep was almost as big as a ping pong ball. It was not a very pleasant surgery, about a 5-hour shoulder surgery. I tried to come back and play for your Long Island Ducks out there because I was so scarred after that surgery that nobody wanted to touch me, of course. And, you know, it was a half an hour effort to get loose to throw one inning and throw 86 miles an hour. So it was at that point, about 3 or 4, you know, months of just beating my head against the proverbial wall, that I finally decided, you know, this is my ship has sailed, my days are over, let's get on to the next segment of life.
Yeah, and let me play a little devil's advocate with you, because, you know, I think that this is what a lot of fans, at least here in New York, are going to say. You know, the cynic's going to say that you loved the spotlight, a young John Rocker back in 1999, you had a career year, and you took on New York, you took on the Mets, and I'm not saying that the fans didn't treat you poorly, because look, I was at Game 3, I was there at Chase Stadium, they threw stuff at you, they cursed at you, you know, that's over the top, and I don't know if today that would be allowed as much as it was back then.
Well, and today, you know, 37-year-old John Rocker, and I've got a quote in the book, you know, I wish 37-year-old John Rocker could go back and punch 23-year-old John Rocker in his face.
So you felt you were over the top, because I look back at some of the video before this interview.
I didn't, you
antagonized the Met fans a little bit. I mean, you have to admit that.
But let's stop at this, though. I did not initiate the antagonism. Didn't initiate, you know, some of the things I was doing. It was all in reciprocation from what I was receiving. I've always been, even back then when I was a young, hot-headed, idiot kid, I didn't ever look for a fight. I never pick a fight. But if you brought one to me, I was not about to back down. And you know, that mentality is what made me a good closer. That mentality is what also probably, extenuated situations that probably, shouldn't have had the life they had.
Did it happen before 99? Was it something that happened in 98? Because 99 was the year you guys – and let me tell you, that series, I was talking with a writer, very underrated series. I mean, you guys won, but that was a great series.
It was an absolutely great series. I still hear about the Grand Slam single from Robin and things like that. It was an absolutely phenomenal series. It really was. And then the way the Mets got there, beating the Reds in game 163 that year, you know, a one-game winner-take-all kind of thing, the way the Mets got there, you know, the way they fought back from, you know, seemingly being, no breath left in their body. They fought back and made it the series. The Mets had a great team that day. They really did. And, I know we beat the Mets handily during the regular season that year, but they just would not go away. I mean, they were a very tough, a very tough opponent that year, all year long, regardless of what the record showed.
And a lot of people felt that if that had gone to Game 7, that you guys want to know part of that because the momentum wasn't in your favor. Is that true?
Absolutely not. I mean, when you have someone down, we were up 3-0, you win Game 4, you win Game 5. I don't care if you're up 3-0. When someone forces you to a Game 6, you start getting a little worried. I mean, you start getting a little tight. And we had to beat them in extras, in Game 6 to do that. And believe me, we were a bit worried. We really were. They had a great team. You know, Piazza and Ventura and Olerud and those guys, great staff. I mean, they were stocked. They really were.
Now, in the article, you kind of – and the feeling always with Met fans was that you and Chipper Jones and the Braves, you hated New York. You didn't like Bobby Valentine. You didn't like that Mets team. Was that an inaccurate portrayal, or, again, are those young guys kind of getting caught up?
Every big league player always has a tremendous amount of respect for every other big league player. It's a funny anomaly. I can go to events, to parties, to whatever, you know, Super Bowl and things like that, where you see, you know, quite a mixture of all, you know, athletes from all different, you know, all different genres. I can run into a big league guy who I never played with and had never met, but simply because you're a big league guy and we're part of that same fraternity, we're instant friends. You know, hey, so-and-so, how you doing? Good to see you. How's the family? Whatever. I've never met you, but because you've got, you know, on your resume, current and or, you know, retired big league, you know, ball player, you're an instant friend. So, I mean, just because you trash talk and whatever else, and you may say things that, you know, in the media are construed a little bit and not, really put in the media, you know, generally how they were meant, you know, that's sort of, I guess the way the media wants to build up the hype or whatever. But as far as having respect for other big league players and or managers, whatever, you may talk your trash in the media, like I said, maybe misconstrued, it may be, you know, made to be a bit bigger of a deal or taking it, presented in a different vein than it was meant. Every big league player has a tremendous amount of respect for every other big league player. We just do.
There's a certain amount of theater. I agree with that. When Perlman came down to Georgia, you know, knowing, you know, that series was emotional, you know, he's a guy that grew up a Mets fan, had written a book about the Mets.
A very unflattering book about the Mets. Very unflattering and very unfair, I thought.
Right. And Perlman, and I've had him on the show, and look, I'll be the first to admit he takes a very political slant on things. He's a controversial guy. Did that crush your mind? Were you completely blindsided? Because, again, that stuck to you, and I think it's unfair, but, you know, was anything that was written completely false in that article, or was it mainly he just painted the wrong picture on
it? No, it painted a tremendously wrong picture. Actually, when I sat down with Jeff, I had been, in and around, in clubhouses, around him, numerous times, leading up to that article. He was pretty much my age. We were, we were kind of buddy-buddy, sort of chummy, whatever. I never knew until obviously after the fact that literally his MO is sort of a disparaging MO. I mean, whatever article, book he writes generally is going to have a negative overtone. Now, he just came out with a book about Walter Payton, and to me, to a pretty significant degree, disparages Walter Payton. I mean, how do you disparage a guy like Walter Payton, an American football icon? I mean, literally paints Walter Payton in a bad picture, painted the 86 Mets in a bad picture, the 1990 Dallas Cowboys in a bad picture. And in one article, and I actually talked to David about this, David Wells in 2001, I believe, while he was playing for the Toronto Blue Jays, was leading the AL in wins, strikeouts, and ERA. And did a feature article about 2 weeks prior to the All-Star game, which he was going to start. David was, sat down with Perlman. Perlman did a Sports Illustrated article on David. It was about a four-page article. Jeff spent three of the four pages talking about David's, his physical stature, his overall look, his hygiene. I mean, just really painted an awful, just almost like a troll-like, appearance of David Wells. And then, oh, by the way, he's starting the All-Star game and leave the AL in every important category as far as pitching is concerned. It was a slam job on David. And post-article, David's quote was, John Rocker was his first victim. I guess I'm the second. I mean, that David's obviously very upset about that. Look, I'm having a career year. I'm leaving the American League in every, and basically the triple crown categories of pitching. All he focuses on is that I'm overweight. My goatee is unkempt. I like to, have some beers after a game, which is all that, that Perlman focused on. And then, oh, by the way, the guy's the best pitcher in the American League this year, probably will win the Cy Young, starting the All-Star game. I mean, very little mention about that. Just look for some reason to tear David apart. And actually, me and David have talked about that. He still has a little thorn in his side about that article.
Interesting. I have with me John Rocker, former Braves pitcher. He has a website, johnrocker.net, and a book, Scars and Strikes, that he wrote. And I'll give you credit, John. You know, a lot of people don't know that you have over 20 scoreless innings in the postseason. And I was also at Shea Stadium the night you came back in 2000. And, the security, you made the statement. And I got to give you credit. You know, you came out, they flung the plastic bottles at you again, and you shut the Mets down. I mean, you seem to not – I don't know if you thrived on that. I'm sure you didn't want all that attention, and I'm sure Bobby Cox and the team didn't want all that attention. But you came out, and no matter what happened, you rose to the occasion. I got to give you credit. You know, talk about that night. That was a weird night. I was a fan at the time, a young guy in the ballpark, but that was a weird night, too, in the ballpark
It was a weird night, and no matter what night it was that I went out there to close the game out, you know whatever kind of atmosphere I was pitching in, I always tried to reduce it to a very simplistic level. At the end of the day, I had, 24 other guys on the team that had generally worked their butts off to get us to a leading situation in the ninth inning. Obviously, the coaching staff and, several million fans all sitting squarely on my shoulders that wanted to see the Braves win that night. You got to block it all out. You got to take the fastball out of your glove, throw it downhill toward the mitt, and, let's just see what happens. So you try to keep it as basic as possible, try to ignore all the circus atmosphere. Did I want the circus atmosphere? It didn't necessarily bother me. Would my druthers be to have it a different way? Yes, but, it was what it was. Let's just make the best of it and try to get, the team a win, obviously a very important win anytime we play the Mets, in division rival, because there was a lot more riding on that game than just me and this whole, fisticuff between me and the Mets and the Mets fans and whatever else. That's, that's secular. That's sort of sideline stuff. Let's get down to the business of what I'm being paid for to win a ball game, and let's just get that done.
How was your relationship with your teammates after that? I mean, obviously, Randall Simon, you took a shot at in that article. Perlman had you take a shot at him. Did it affect you? Because it seemed like, you pitched pretty well. And, look, at the end of the day, you don't have to love all 25 guys. How was that after that article?
Well, I mean, as far as some of the more veteran guys, Glav and Smoltz and Maddox and guys like that, didn't really like, the atmosphere that was created. But what people just really have refused to acknowledge, especially during that 2 or 3 year period of time where the media so desperately wanted some kind of backup information, some kind of, backup comments or quotes or whatever, saying, yep, that article painted John Ryder absolutely precisely, how Jeff Perlman intended to be. Instead, what you got was many, current teammates, ex-teammates, from, Ellis Burks and guys like that, going forward, from, your Brian Jordans, your Andrew Joneses, your Javi Lopez's, Eddie Perez, those guys said, whoa, hold the phone here. We've known John for, in some cases, a decade. This article, we've never seen this John Rocker that's been portrayed in this article. We've never seen it. He's been a dear friend of ours for 10 years, and, we really don't know where this article has come from. That was largely ignored. So, from where a Javi Lopez is concerned, where a Brian Jordan is concerned, where those guys are concerned, we were just buddies. I mean, they knew me. A lot of me and Andrew, from the very first day I walked in the professional clubhouse when I was 18 years old, and I talk about this, the very first day I was in a major league, a professional baseball clubhouse, I actually have this little, this little quote in the book, this little story in the book. I walk in the clubhouse and see a shirtless Andrew Jones walking to the clubhouse with his, his big signature grin on his face, kind of strutting like, I invented the game. I'm like, who in the blankety blank is this guy, And, we became very dear friends. We lived together for 3 of my 4 years in minor league baseball. Me and Andrew lived together and still to this day are very dear friends. I mean, Andrew came to my defense left and right, but it was just largely ignored. And, I mean, those guys, that they slough it off, to a large degree. I would say to a unanimous degree, and we're still friends. 10 years later, of an article like that tried to portray me as some just, mean, monstrous bigot that, oh, you're a foreigner, I don't like you, or whatever. I mean, these guys, they kind of chuckled at it, like, we know you, buddy, and we're always going to be friends. We've been friends, since our teenage years, and nothing really changed.
John Charles, you take him to task in the book. Look, I know it's about arbitration, and the arbitration process is kind of a tough process to go through because, teams got to basically disparage their own player. But John Charles takes him on the chin a little bit in this book, huh?
Actually, I left John out of this. I didn't.
You did? Okay.
I don't, me and John, we've not always really seen eye to eye, and he's not the GM anymore. He's the president of the team now, and Frank Wren's the GM. But and obviously, John is a shrewd businessman. He runs the team and has run the team obviously very well for, you know, the better part of the last 20 years. John he deserves too much, he deserves so much respect, for what he's done for the organization, what he's done for me directly. I really couldn't find fault with John in this book. Did I like what went down, that whole arbitration thing? Not necessarily. But at the end of the day, he is looking out for the bottom line of the Atlanta Braves, for the bottom line of Ted Turner. If doing what he thought was best in that arbitration case to ultimately save the Atlanta Braves, a few dollars for the next season, if he thought that was best, I'm not going to argue for him, argue against him. As far as taking someone to task, Bud Selig definitely takes it on the chin.
Really, Bud Selig. But I'm not a fan of Selig. I think he's kind of one of the commissioners that rules by consensus, and he's a bit of a coward, if you ask me. But what's the big problem with Selig?
I mean, can we do another segment? I need an entire segment to tell you. And you just hit. He is a spineless coward. Was, and for all practical purposes, is still an owner in Major League Baseball. I'm also the commissioner. If there's a drastic conflict of interest there, it's my very strong opinion, and I don't think you would find any other Major League player to disagree with me, the whole steroid scandal, it will scar and mar Major League Baseball, for generations to come, decades to come. If a more astute leader was the commissioner during that whole period of time, I have no doubt in my mind Major League Baseball would not be glaring with the black eye it has and will continue to have over the whole steroid thing. Roger Clemens would not be, losing sleep at night thinking, am I going to go to jail because I possibly perjured myself in front of Congress? Alex Rodriguez would not be losing sleep at night thinking, because I have an asterisk beside my name, despise, in my opinion, Alex is the greatest baseball player to ever live. I played with Alex for a year in Texas. I don't think I'll ever be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think Mark McGwire will. I don't think now Roger Clemens will. And in large part, it's my strong opinion that the way Selig handled that, the way he allowed that whole story, to flow out into third-party mediums, Congress, Mitchell, media, everything else, and just allowed it.
And your name was thrown around a little bit with that stuff, right? Weren't you kind of thrown around?
But here's the thing, and here's where I go over all this in my book. When all this SI thing came out, the commissioner's office in Selig was obviously extremely upset with me. They asked me on four different occasions over about a two-week period of time to take a steroid test. The first three times, I refused. The fourth time, my agent literally pled with me, please, the commissioner's office is extremely upset with you. You need to take this test. If you take the test, possibly you pacify them. They go a little bit easier on you when they finally render your reprimand. Okay, fine, I'll take it. So someone from the testing division calls me up. John, this test is going to be totally private. The only people who know the results are us, the testing agency, and you yourself. Well, I take the test. Okay, fine. As my agent instructed, I take the test. When the results were administered about a week later, my agent told me what the results were. And I was kind of confused. I'm like, if somebody is so adamant about wanting you to take a test about steroids, but they don't want to know the results, what's the point of taking the test? The whole point of taking a test is to ultimately find out the results, is it not?
Right.
If you don't want to know the results, why take the test? So therefore, you have a commissioner's office who was extremely irritated at me that insisted over a two-week period of time, over four inquisitions, that I take this test. I finally succumb. Okay, I'll take the test. I, of course, failed it miserably. And you mean to tell me the commissioner's office, who insisted over 2 weeks, over four different occasions, that I take a steroid test, they don't know the result of said test?
Now, you say you failed the test? Is that accurate? You just said you failed the test?
Oh, absolutely. I failed it miserably. Of course I did.
You were taking some sort of performance-enhancing drugs. This is 1999 you're talking about, right?
Yeah, of course I was. It wasn't. Let's be honest here, it wasn't.
Right. Let me ask you this question, because I've had this argument with Perlman. Because Perlman and I, about the Hall of Fame, and it starts with Biggio and Bagwell, they've never, as far as the public knows, have failed the test. But because of their proximity where they played to Mexico, he wants to keep them out. And I'm like, first of all, we don't really know. Yeah.
But because they wore a Houston Astro uniform,
yes.
Which happens to be really.
Yeah, well, this is the argument I've had with him. And I said, you know, Bagwell and Biggio, and I'll tell you what, I mean, Bagwell, you know, was pretty consistent throughout his career. You know, again, you don't know who was taken, who wasn't. You know, obviously you would know more than I. But I even so, I still don't know. I mean, John, did you become a good pitcher because of it?
No. I mean, can I throw 3 or 4 miles an hour harder because of it? Yes. Was I a good pitcher? Was my breaking ball better because of it? No. But, I mean, the reason was is, you know, like I talked about earlier in the interview, you know, with you know, my teammates and their confidence laying on my shoulders, with the coaching staff and their confidence on my shoulders, with the millions of Atlanta Braves fans, I'm not going to step on that mound with that kind of responsibility with my gun half loaded. I'm just not knowing
right.
The people I'm going to be facing. I know what they're doing. I'm not coming to the mound half cocked. But getting back to Selig, at that point in time, you know, he's denied, you know, knowing the outcome of that test, which he insisted I take, which that's absolute BS. At that point in time, seeing these animals around the league, these gorillas, these Mark McGuires that are, you know, 6'6" and 290 pounds, I mean, please, you know. At that point in time, he should have taken my test. And here's where I have fault with him. A more intelligent, a more astute, a more responsible commissioner would have said, look, I think we got a problem here. John Rocker failed this test. I look around the league. I'm not an idiot. You know, I see these guys with these bulging veins and bulging muscles, and they stand the plate, you know, swinging their 36-inch bat like it's a toothpick. I insist we have a more in-depth investigation on steroids in baseball. And, you know, Player Association, if you don't like it, then tough, stick it. Here's what we're going to do. Instead, it blew up in everyone's face in 2004, 2005, and we all know the story since then.
Right.
So that's the problem I have with Selig. He because he would rather climb under his desk and just let the fallout, you know, be dealt with by everyone else. And it has been dealt with everyone else, you know, most notably Major League Baseball, its players, its Players Association, and you've got, you know, icons of the game, Roger Clemens, who, you know, in my opinion, is the best pitcher to ever live, will probably never be in the Hall of Fame. And, I mean, his name, you know, going forward is publicly scarred. It just is. Because
right.
He did not have the guts back in 2000 when he saw my steroid test to come out and say, look, we got a problem. We're going to deal with this within the walls of Major League Baseball before it gets out into media, it gets out into Congress, which I have to laugh when even you know, make that statement there, and becomes an all-out circus. But he didn't do it. It became a circus, and it almost makes, you know, Major League Baseball a laughingstock. It did for several years, and will continue to have the black eye, you know, going forward, like I said, for decades to come.
Now, John, am I off base? I'm not one that wants to keep or wants to see guys kept out of the Hall of Fame over it, even if they – I mean, look, Bonds was a Hall of Famer before this stuff. He was superhuman after this stuff. Even Rafael Palmeiro, he's got 3,000 hits. To me, it's a period where it wasn't illegal per se in the bylaws of the game, and it's hard for me scientifically. And I've challenged Perlman and I challenged other writers. Show me scientifically how much better they were, these players – and I don't think anyone has that answer. Am I wrong in thinking that? You know, because you played. Is it, you know, looking back?
I mean, it. You know, obviously recovery time is better on things like that. You know, if a guy's going to hit a ball 380 feet naturally, he takes some things like that. He's going to hit one 400, you know, the same ball 410 feet, therefore a home run. So it will turn a long fly ball into a home run. Does it make his hand-eye coordination better? Does it make his pitch selection better? Does it make him, you know, as far as the intangibles of hitting, the intangibles of pitching, does it make that aspect of the game better? No, but it will mask a mistake, you know, i.e. a missed ball that you don't hit quite square. It carries over the wall, whereas without it, it may be a warning track fly ball. You know, a guy that throws, you know, 93 miles an hour now throws 98. That there is some difference there. But there again, at that point in time, it was a level playing field. There was enough people that were doing it that, you know, if you weren't doing it, you were selling yourself short, and, you know, your team would ultimately suffer. They would. And I was not going to allow, you know, my teammates to lose ball games because of my, some moral conviction that I had of, I'm not going to, but yet I'm going to face someone that is, and he's going to hit a two-run home run off me, and we're going to ultimately lose the game, miss out on the playoff berth, miss out on the World Series, when I knew, good and well what was going on 60 feet downrange of who I was facing.
Right. Are you? Did you have any side effects? Are you healthy today? You have no, issues because of the use of steroids, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't. Not at all. So.
Right. One last thing with this regarding the book, and the book again is Scars and Strikes. So you can check it out at johnrocker.net. I think politically, and you mentioned this earlier in the interview, this whole article has painted you in a way, and I know you've been on Fox News. I think you were on Hannity and Colmes a while back, and I know that you're passionate about politics, and I think that's been misrepresented at times. If someone picks up this book, do you think they'll get a better view of where you stand on that? It's not just you ranting and raving, as like you said earlier.
No, they definitely will. And I've said in other interviews, which you just mentioned, I love talking politics. I enjoy politics. Right now with the heating GOP debates and things like that coming up to the elections in Iowa next month, things like that. I love watching politics. It intrigues me. Just all the aspects of the political debates, whether it's your immigration, whether it's your fiscal policies, whether it's whatever, it really intrigues me. And this 10 hours that I spent, nearly a decade ago with Jeff Perlman talking, a lot of, some of it was baseball, some of it was just miscellaneous nothing, a lot of it was politics. And when you engage in a 20-minute conversation about immigration policy and things like that, and someone chooses out of a 20-minute conversation to take a 5-word quote here and an 8-word quote there and jab it into the article they're writing to paint the kind of picture they're trying to paint about you, which I think Jeff Perlman has definitely showed what kind of MO he has with the works he's put out there, from the Mets 86 book, from the David Wells article, from the book he just wrote about Walter Payton. I mean, his MO is to disparage athletes in whatever angle he thinks that he can he can create. With mine, he decided. He decided he would create a racist, bigoted kind of angle and disparage me in that way. And there was several years, about 5 or 6 years, I swore off print journalism. I would not do a print article, print interview for anyone, because it was always my opinion that me as the interviewee, I was integral to the whole process. When I sat down with a journalist, they already had in their mind the theme, the tone, everything else that article was going to be about, negative, positive, whatever else. All they needed me for was the ability to put a little quote here and a little quote there just to give their article legitimacy. And that was basically it. And I've sat down with so many print journalists, and we've had good rapport, have got along well, pre-interview, post-interview, you're kind of buddy-buddy, you're chummy-chummy. You read the article, you're like, is that the same interview I was a part of? Really?
Right.
Because you hear the theme, you hear the tone, you're like, this guy's ripping me apart, and then sticks a quote here, sticks a quote there, just to make it seem all legitimate. He had the idea of what he was going to write being a negative theme, a negative tone, long before we sat down and actually had the interview. And I find most print journalists do that.
Right. Well, they're trying to build their own narrative. Are you supporting anybody in the Republican primary yet, or are you still kind of vetting this thing out?
I have always loved Newt Gingrich. I mean, I know he's not the most charismatic guy out there. I've loved to hear him talk. I'd love to hear his commentaries on whatever forum I can find him on the last, 10, 15 years. I mean, he is an absolute genius, just a marksman in historical value of, pretty much anything you want to discuss. I mean, I think he's an absolute genius. I think he's got obviously the intelligence, he's got the experience. I don't necessarily like that he's a lifetime politician type. I would just assume see an office like that sort of go back to a Herman Cain, somebody that's just been in the citizen forum, if you will, for the last the better part of his adult life. But I just like Newt Gingrich. I've always liked him. He's always intrigued me. Things he's had to say. I've always liked him. So I would like to see him get the nomination.
Are you done with baseball? You obviously wrote the book. You have your website, johnrocker.net. What, are you done with baseball? Are you looking to coach, or is that it for you? You moved on.
That's it. You know, I'm the only.
Bud Selig's not going to let you in the game now after this interview. Bud doesn't like any kind of people who speak out. You know what I'm saying?
My body's not going to let me back in the game. Bud is integral.
Well, listen, johnrocker.net. John, you've been very kind, generous with your time, and thank you so much, and good luck with the book. And anything else you want to let the listeners know about johnrocker.net, Scars and Strikes, anything else?
That's it. I mean, the book is available on my website right now, hard copy and ebook for delivery now. It'll be on Amazon and iBook and Barnesnoble.com probably by the end of the week. It'll be in stores probably the beginning of the following week. So it's out there, and I think it's a good read. You know, most people, hear obviously what people think about me. I'm an idiot athlete. I'm some, illiterate boob, whatever. I do have a co-writer on this book who helped me do a lot of research, around a few topics as far as the actual writing of the book. I wrote about 98% of this book, from my computer and with my fingers and whatever else. So if you... interested, intrigued about the thoughts and opinions of John Rocker, then this book definitely displays them.
Well, I can already tell you, I already got an email from someone at Mad Dog Radio. They want to have you on the Dino Costa show. So you got at least one interview out of this. So it was worth your 30 minutes, John, talking to a former Mets fan turned talk show host here. So I forgive you for everything I saw. Everything I said about you 10 years ago.
It was all in good fun. It was all for as Walt Weiss would say, it's all for the cameras. So,
right.
It was all in good fun, and like I said, the Mets guys I played against, because they were MLB guys like I was, have the utmost respect for all of the guys I ever played with. And actually, the first chapter of my book is called A Day in the Life, and it's about when I woke up. It's at the Grand Hyatt Hotel on 42nd and Lexington, and it was the first day of the 1999 World Series, and it's from the very first time my eyes opened that day until my very first pitch in the game that night. I talk about just, how spectacular the Yankee fans, were, during that series, especially the very first game of the last World Series of the millennium, all that stuff. I have a tremendous amount of respect for the passion, the fire of New York fans. It makes the atmosphere in Old Shea, I guess, what's the new name of the stadium now?
City Field,
and obviously, I sort of cringe to think that old Yankee Stadium was turned and what was torn down. But, in those atmospheres of which the fans created, I mean, it's like nothing else in baseball, and the players probably loved it more than the fans did.
Yeah, no, it was great stuff. Hey, John, happy holidays. Thanks again, and good luck with the book, and let's catch up again, okay?
No problem. Certainly enjoyed it.
That's John Rocker, former big league pitcher, johnrocker.net. And, wow, I got to tell you guys, we got some nuggets out of him on that one. I mean, I have to tell you, and I know we have I've had our next guest on hold, and I really didn't set up the show because I wanted to get to John. I didn't want to have him hold. And just to let everybody know, David Gershman, who writes for ESPN, and he covers the New York Penn League. He's going to give us some Rule 5 stuff. And John Rocker was supposed to be on like 10, 15 minutes. We got nearly 40 minutes out of him. He was pretty honest. And I got to tell you, maybe I should get Perlman on at some point before we wrap it up, the 2011 shows. I mean, the guy just admitted he took steroids. He failed tests miserably back in 1999. I mean, he just basically admitted on the air, took Bud Selig to task. He didn't sound like an idiot to me, And, look, I know that politically he's probably more to the right than what a lot of people here in New York who root for the Mets, who root for the Yankees are. But, that's his prerogative. I mean, there's a lot of people in baseball who are conservative. A lot of owners, a lot of players. You'd be surprised. And, they just don't make their views known, but you heard what he said. He felt an obligation to obviously take steroids in order to keep up, I guess, with the Joneses, so to speak. But interesting interview with John Rocker. Got a lot more from him than I expected, and the book is Scars and Strikes, johnrocker.net. So I'm sure that'll get some play, and I definitely appreciate John. So let me set this all up here. We're going to get to, we're not going to take any breaks now. We're going to get to David our friend David Gershman. You know, we're going to talk about the Rule 5 draft. I'll give you some of my thoughts on this whole Brian Braun situation. I did want to recap the winter meetings and give you a quick thing from the Mets and Yankees. I don't know how much time we're going to have. I want to keep this to the hour. We'll do that. Let you know, we have one more show next week, and then I'm going to be basically taking the rest of the year off because Christmas and New Year are on a Sunday, so we're going to be taking that time off. And then we're going to be coming back on January 8th for the Hall of Fame show, because the Hall of Fame announcement is January 9th. So I'll be putting out the Hall of Fame ballot so the NYBD readers can we'll do our vote. You know, every time we do a vote, like I said last week when we did the Golden Era ballot, you guys don't vote for anybody. You always – never. No one gets ever gets 75%. So, you know, interesting how that works. Hopefully we get someone elected. I think Jeff Bagwell's got a good shot. Barry Larkin, of course. So it'll be interesting to see how that all turns out. But – anyway, want to get to some winter meetings recap, and one of the things I wanted to do is get a little feel of these Rule 5 picks. So I think the Yankees did a very nice job in the Rule 5 draft, basically picking a couple of players from other organizations. They picked two players. One was a pitcher from the Washington Nationals, Brad Meyers, starting pitcher. Reminds me a lot of Doug Fister in the sense, very much a control pitcher, a guy who's going to go right after hitters. You know, guy that's, you know, not going to dominate, but, you know, is going to wind up putting the ball in play, and he's had a pretty good career, and he's well-regarded. He was a 2009 Nationals Pitcher of the Year, so Brad Meyers is one pick. And then the other pick is a left-handed pitcher, Cesar Cabral, from the Red Sox organization. He was drafted by the Royals in the Rule 5 draft, then the Yankees acquired him for cash considerations from the Royals. And with the fact that Pedro Feliciano's probably out for the year, again, and will never pitch for the Yankees, it looks like they're going to need a second lefty. So I said, you know what, let's go to our buddy. We had him on for our opening day show. He does a lot of work in the New York Penn League. He does a lot of work in the Eastern League. You know, he writes for ESPN. He's all over the place. He's one of the hardest working guys I know in this new media business. It's David Gershman, and he's on with us now. David, I'm sorry for the hold. John Rocker went a little bit over, but thanks for joining me tonight.
Oh, yeah, no problem, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You know, let's start with these two kids. You know, that the Yankees acquired. I love the picks the Yankees did because I actually think the lefty has a chance to stick. I like the Meyers kid. I think the Yankees could maybe work out a deal with Washington. That's the kind of kid I'd want to have in my organization as depth. I don't think either of them have a great shot at making the roster, but a better than your average shot. I think Sandy Alderson said on a conference call recently that there's about a 30% chance that a Rule 5 pick sticks with their club. And I think the Yankees have two guys, more so the lefty than Meyers, that have a chance to stick. Why don't you give a quick rundown of what you think of those two kids?
Yeah, I agree. You know, the thing about the Rule 5 draft is most of the players taken every year don't stick. And you just said that. But I guess more of the players that do stick are pitchers, and left-handed pitchers are the most valuable from the Rule 5 draft. And if you look at recent years, guys like, you know, Joe Patterson from last year, you know, guys like that are the ones that stick. And Cabral, however you say it, was picked last year, and he didn't make it. But, you know, I don't think he was given that much of a shot when the Rays selected him from the Red Sox in last year's draft. But, yeah, you said it with Feliciano out and Cabral being a lefty who had a lot of success in 2011 with the Sea Dogs. And, you know, I got to see him a little bit. He showed pretty good stuff throughout the year. I thought he was much more effective than the year before. I thought he was stronger. He gained more arm strength, and scouts liked him a little bit. But, yeah, you know, I don't think he's going to be anything huge, but I think he does have a good shot to make the roster and be a pretty good lefty out of the pen. I think he has a better shot than Meyers, but I'm not sure how much of an impact he's going to make. But, yeah, the Yankees are going to give him a fair shot, and we'll see what he can do. I think Meyers is another guy who had a lot of success in 2010. Unfortunately, he got injured in the middle of 2010 and had some problems early on in 2011, but he got his act together, and he had a lot of strikeouts for a guy who has underwhelming stuff. You know, I know I just said he's a guy like Doug Fister. You know, I wouldn't make comparisons for a guy like that, but I think, you know, Doug Fister is on the right track. He's a guy, Meyers is a guy with a fastball that doesn't really sit anywhere near the mid-90s, kind of a low-90s guy, high 80s. And he has a pretty good slider, and that's how he gets his strikeouts. And, you know, if you have a guy like that in the pen or even in the rotation as a back-end guy, there's a good chance he'll be successful if he's healthy, if he's throwing strikes, if he's getting batters out, and I've never seen him face hitters outside of the Eastern League, but you know, I did hear that he had a lot of success with Syracuse later on in the year. So we'll see how that turns out. But I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Yankees handle these two guys in spring training. I know both are going to be given a shot to make the roster, especially with, as we talked about before, injuries to Pedro Feliciano and the Yankees' rotation is a little bit unclear right now. But we'll see what happens with that. I know that that Cabral, if I had to put my money on one of the players to stick more than the other, I think it would be Cesar Cabral, just because I liked him a lot more when I saw him than Myers, and I know he had more success, and he's a lefty, and that's really good. So
I'm surprised he hasn't moved. I mean, I guess the question everyone asked about Cabral, the lefty, is that he's with the Red Sox, and the scouting report is really solid. You know, solid frame, smooth delivery, you know, fastball that, you know, between 88 and 92. Has a pretty good secondary changeup. I guess Pedro Feliciano, he sounds a little like Pedro Feliciano. How come he hasn't had a chance to make it somewhere? I mean, that's, I guess, the question everyone's going to ask.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I'm not really sure of why, but I know he was a little bit flashy. He was a little bit inconsistent this year, but when he was on, he was getting better, swinging on his slider. He was showing a good fastball. I know his fastball did dip a little bit, I guess, towards the middle of the season, and he had a few rough stints, but yeah, he was good enough to, you know, I think at least be a solid lefty at a major league pen, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how he translates, you know, I guess half a year later since he was pitching for the Red Sox organization. Yeah, but if he is given a shot at the Yankees pen, I think you know, I would expect what you would probably have expected last year if he had made the Red Sox pen, just a guy with just solid stuff, nothing special, nothing overpowering, but good enough to get batter swing and probably a good guy to face lefties late in the game.
Right. You know, I agree with you on that. You got a lot going on there since opening day. Now, we talked right before opening day, Dave, and you're with ESPN now. You got the Marlins Daily. You Beyond the Box Score. Talk about what you got going on. You know, you covered the Blue Jays AA affiliate, the new Fisher Cats, New Hampshire, a lot of Penn League stuff. You're all over the place. You're like, you know, you wear like 50 different hats. I got to give you credit. That's a lot of hustle. Talk about your year. You've had a real breakout year in terms of this business.
Well, thanks, Mike. Yeah, it's definitely fun to have so many outlets you know, that I write for, and I had a great season covering the Fisher Cats, covering teams in the New York Penn League, and it was mostly fun. At the end of the season, I got to enjoy two champagne showers with the Fisher Cats and the Staten Island Yankees. And it's annoying when the season ends. You know, you sit around at home saying, "What do I do now?" But I've still been writing for Marlins Daily. The Marlins has had a huge offseason so far, and it's been fun. You know, my writers and I covering that and discussing that on the site. I had some ESPN articles back when the season was still going on, and that was nice. But yeah, it's tough being a writer when the season ends. You know, you try to sit around writing about, you know, games that are going on, and then there's no games, so it's that's tough. But I'm definitely looking forward to next season. I'm still a Penn League report. I'm still gonna be writing for Beyond the Box Score and Marlins Daily.
Why the Marlins? How did you get involved with the Marlins?
Well, I remember when the Sweet Spot blog, when the ESPN Sweet Spot Network was asking, you know, around if there were any teams if there were any writers that were interested in filling the few holes that were open. I guess the White Sox, the Angels, the Marlins, the Pirates were the only teams that didn't have a writer. So I spoke to a couple people over there, and I told them I was a writer for Beyond the Box Score, and I guess they were familiar with my work, and they were happy to have me on. And it was definitely tough to do the Marlins stuff and cover the Fisher Cats and the Penn League, you know, all at once. But I managed to do that. I had a great time with the Fisher Cats, and that was a very memorable season. But yeah, you know, the Marlins. Hopefully that gets you know, bigger, and my writers and I keep progressing and putting up good stuff on the site. That's the hope.
Right. What do you think of this whole Ryan Braun situation? Ryan Braun right now it looks like they're looking through these high testosterone levels. He failed his test. You just heard John Rocker admit to failing a drug test in 1999 that they made him take just because they were looking to suspend him for the Perlman article. You know, we know that the game has been, you know, obviously rampant with steroids for a while. I'm not a guy that gets all bent out of shape about this stuff. You know, there's a lot of over-the-counter stuff that was out there that was legal back then. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that you could consider performance enhancement. I mean, someone made a great point on Twitter today. Isn't LASIK surgery performance enhancement when you think about it?
Right.
You know, to me, first of all, to talk about taking his MVP away is ridiculous. This isn't the NCAA. You know, the NCAA wants to erase history. You don't take an MVP trophy away because you have no idea how that – you know, first of all, you don't know if he's guilty because he's appealing it, and who knows what high testosterone levels mean. Second of all, you don't know, even if he did take something, the impact truly – you know, Rocker did say there is, but, how, you know, how do you quantify that?
Right.
You know, to me, the media – these are frustrated White House correspondents that are trying to make something out of the candy store into a serious issue. Do you agree with that? What's your take on it?
Absolutely. I definitely agree with what you said. I think it's too premature to make assessments and judgments based on what we know so far. I think, you know, from what we do know so far, it is embarrassing and a little bit sad, you know, of what happened. And Ryan Braun, the thing is Ryan Braun, you know, a case could be made that he had better seasons in previous years than this one, and we don't know if he took steroids in those years. So I think he's still an excellent player, PEDs. He's still an excellent player off PEDs if he did take them this year. And it's definitely sad. That's all that's been running through my mind, just how disappointing it is, I think, for baseball and for Braun and the Brewers, especially after winning the MVP. I think I don't even think Braun was the best player this year. I think Matt Kemp should have been the MVP. And I agree with you in the sense that, you know, you can't take away someone's MVP. All that talk is silly, but it is disappointing seeing him win the MVP and now hearing about this, the PEDs. It's so unclear, you know, what makes performance-enhancing drugs. You know, as you said, LASIK surgery is performance-enhancing. There's so many ways to enhance a player's performance, and we don't really know any of the details except that he did take PEDs. And I think people commenting and making assessments, saying things like that, is silly until we know further details.
Let me get your I'll give you a quick take here on winter meetings and where we stand. I'll give you a quick Yankee, quick Met thing. I want to hear your thoughts. I know both teams were rather, I wouldn't say the Mets were quiet, but they were fishing in the shallow end of the pool in terms of free agency. Yankees were quiet except for the Rule 5 draft and the signing of the bid posting of the Japanese shortstop.
Yeah.
We don't know what's going to go on with that. And I got some word earlier tonight. I was talking to Frank Russo, our good friend, author of the book Bury My Heart in Cooperstown. And they actually did it to block the Red Sox, who really wanted him. You know, and I know Bobby Valentine's in Boston now, so there's obviously going to be a lot of interest in NPB and Far East players. But when I look at the Yankees, I think Hiroki Kuroda is a perfect fit. They denied making an offer. He's looking for about $12 million a year. I know they want to stay under or, you know, they want to manage the luxury tax threshold because of this revenue-sharing bonus they'd get of about $40 million in a couple of years. I think Kuroda's perfect. If they don't sign a Kuroda, I'm okay with them not getting a Darvish. I think they have Noezi. You know, they've been talking him up a lot. Of course, Ivan Nova. I think they have a lot of young pitchers. You could always acquire a veteran like a Kuroda type in the middle of the year. You know, as the Sabathia goes is how they go. If Sabathia regresses, that rotation's in trouble. Like any rotation would be in trouble if they lost their ace. Now, as far as the Mets, I'm not all that – and you're in Marlins, obviously, blogger over there, so maybe you have a good take. I think they should have matched that offer. A team with the New York payroll should be able to match that offer. I'm not crying about it because I think that long range, they're trying to clean up these obtuse contracts. You know, you got Santana and Bay making about 40% of the payroll. They got a lot of high on base percentage guys with potential in that lineup. They're going to have a pretty strong bullpen. Their rotation is not going to be outstanding. It's going to be fair. They got a lot of number threes in there, threes, fours, and fives. I think they'll be competitive. You know, even if they lose, let's say, 90 games, I don't think they're going to be a mess out there. So where they are in terms of their development, I can't complain. I'm actually okay where both these teams are at. Is that a fair assessment, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. I think the one thing about the Yankees and Mets entering the winter meetings, or even the offseason for that matter, is that aside from the Mets really needing a closer and the Yankees having a few back end of the rotation problems, there wasn't a clear, you know, there wasn't one of those holes that you say, you know, the Yankees and the Mets have to fill this hole. They need to spend a lot of money to sign a big name. It wasn't like that. And the Mets signed Rauch and Francisco, and the Yankees signed Garcia a couple weeks ago, and they're still looking for a starter in the back end. But I don't think there's any problem with just taking the offseason slow and signing a couple guys later when bargains are more available. But yeah, I think a guy like Kuroda would make a lot of sense for the Yankees, and I'm sure the Mets could find a few cheap guys who could fill holes. But I don't think entering the offseason there was any chance that the Mets or Yankees would sign Pujols or make a big splash. You know, I think the Mets could have re-signed Reyes, but I don't think I don't think it's that big of a deal that neither team has made a splash or signed any huge names yet. It's a little boring. It's a little disappointing that both teams haven't really improved on paper, but there's still time, and I think it's fair to say the Mets might have similar success that they did last year, and the Yankees will still be a good team as long as, you said, Sabathia and everyone else expected to play well, does play well. So we'll see what happens with that. I think it's worth keeping an eye on the players who are going to be on the market for a little bit longer. Even bullpen guys for the Mets, probably starters for the Yankees, some infield guys for the Mets too. We'll see. But I think it's also, you know, the Mets made a trade a couple weeks ago. It's worth keeping an eye on the guys already in the pen, seeing how they play in spring training and as the season starts. For now, I guess it'd just be worth keeping an open mind with both teams and their off-season spending.
Well, listen, you've been a great guest tonight. You followed a tough act with Rocker. give the listeners everything you want them to know, what you got going on over the next couple of weeks at your various outlets out there.
Well, I'm definitely going to be writing a lot more over at Beyond the Box Score and ESPN and the Marlins Daily. Now that you know, I'll have a lot more time. Now that work is over, I'm going to be home for a few weeks, which is good. And we're going to start up the podcast. Matt Clausen from FanGraphs and I still have our Beyond the Box Score podcast, and we're going to start that up again probably next Tuesday, which is exciting. I wish the season was starting next week instead of 3 months from now.
You're a junkie. You're a baseball junkie. I got to give you credit. I follow you at @Dave_Gershman on Twitter. So, you know, that's you're a baseball junkie. I got to give you credit. You're a hard worker. You're exactly the new wave of writers. I enjoy your work, and I really appreciate you staying on hold and spending a few minutes here late on a Sunday. All right, Dave?
Oh, absolutely, Mike. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. That's Dave Gershman at @Dave_Gershman on Twitter, and ESPN, Marlins Daily, Beyond the Box Score, and he does a whole bunch of stuff. We're out of time. It's amazing. What a great night. You know, I really enjoyed the Rocker interview, and I hope you did too, and I think we got some interesting nuggets, and hopefully you got a different point of view, and I don't think he's such a bad guy, to tell you the truth. I mean, you know, he said things. He even admitted as a youngster he probably would want to smack himself, and I think all of us could appreciate that, because I think all of us would love to talk to some of our younger beings if we had a chance and smarten them up or guide them and ask them to kind of take a different direction if it's possible. So, you know, interesting nonetheless. But we'll be back, like I said, next week, 8 o'clock on Sunday. That'll be our final show of 2011. We'll be doing our Man of the Year stuff, so stay tuned for that. Go to the website for our ballot, our NYBD Hall of Fame ballot. The app is all up and running. It's back in the Droid store, so you can get it for your Droid and your iPhone. I'll have that info up there. It's actually in the posting of the show. And just keep going to nybaseballdigest.com for the latest in New York baseball. But right now, we're out of time, but you can listen to the replay of this show or any show at nybaseballdigest.com. I'd like to thank John Rocker. Check out johnrocker.net and his book, Scars and Strikes. I want to thank his publicist, Debbie Curzio. She helped set up the interview, so I want to thank Debbie for that. I want to thank Dave Gershman. You can check him out on Twitter, @Dave_Gershman, ESPN, Marlins Daily, Beyond the Box Score. I want to thank Blog Talk Radio at 1240 AM, WGBB, for hosting this show. I want to thank our friends at the CMEDS, the National Podcasting Network. And, of course, remember to tune in for the best features, interviews, opinions, and analysis on New York baseball at nybaseballdigest.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your night. We'll be back next Sunday. Till then, take care.